Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com 2 days a week now during 2016 for your listening pleasure. That's just by my choice. You know, I've got lots and lots of videos to make and editing to do and a documentary to work on and, oh my God, doing music and comedy and such and blah, blah, blah. Just, it was driving me nuts doing 4 or 5 days a week of the show, and quite frankly, I was so behind on editing that I just couldn't put you through the delays anymore, ladies and gentlemen. Try to get that stuff up as quickly as possible, and if we're doing 2 days a week, that's not too difficult. However, I'm still failing miserably. God, I'm a useless bastard sometimes. I really am.
There's never enough time in the day, Vinny.
The voice you're hearing is my very special guest from Postman Productions down south in New Zealand, Ben Vigen, who we've had on the show a number of times before. Some of you might remember he's the man with the no show on harp activity in Christchurch and all of that kind of stuff. And of course, Ben doesn't want to be labelled like that and be thrown.
It's the ironic thing, right?
When something's truthful, when something's honest, when something's actually being reported on with credibility, despite the fact that it sounds crazy, it doesn't change that fact. You know what I'm saying? And it's a real pain in the ass that in order to report credible things with integrity, you have to brave being called a crazy conspiracy theorist in the current media platform, don't you?
Hey, to be fair, Vinny, I wasn't called crazy. The Minister of Internal Affairs called me moderately nuts. So, you know, I'm only halfway nuts. I'm not fully bonkers.
Well, you can't please everybody.
So, I've covered all sorts of things. I've covered HAARP in my first book, State Secrets, which was published in 1999, looked at the role of organized crime and big business in New Zealand and throughout the Pacific. And it's quite interesting because when we published that book, it went straight to the bestsellers list in New Zealand in 1999. I was a first-time author. New Zealand only has a population of less than 4 million. So, you know, when we sell 10,000 books, that's a lot. You know, in America, that's the equivalent of selling 100 million books. So as a first-time author, I sold 15,000 books straight to the bestsellers list. Didn't get a single review in any newspaper in the country. I was told I was a conspiracy theorist, that there was no such thing as organized crime. The following year, the New Zealand police released their first survey over on organized crime in New Zealand, identified more than 375 foreign criminal syndicates operating within New Zealand that had effectively infiltrated every branch of the government, as I'd said in my book. So 10 years later, in fact, 20 years later, if you read that book today, I think most people would say that I painted a very, very accurate picture about what New Zealand's crime and corruption scene was. I was just, unfortunately, too early. And because I wasn't part of the mainstream club, I didn't get any accolades. And it's pretty much what I've been doing for the last 20 years is reporting on stuff which I keep getting told is rubbish and full of crap. Then a year or 2 years later, a story breaks and it turns out that my scoop was actually correct. Yet, you know, that never gets really brought into the equation when the next thing I report about, people who don't turn around and say, wait a minute, that's a guy that got that story, that story, that story, that story, that story, that story right. It just becomes, oh, no, that's all full of crap. So once again, they ignore your complete record of my record for research and my record for getting things right. And the end result is, you know, for 20 years, I have reported about the dark side of New Zealand and the world, which I call the fear factory. And it was pretty much getting me very, very down. So what I thought I'd do is I thought I'd try something a little bit different when I started my next project, which is what we're going to talk about today. In 2014, I decided to hitchhike around New Zealand. And for those of you who are not clued up, obviously New Zealand's where they shot the movie Lord of the Rings. One of the things I sort of did in my book in a very lighthearted fashion was that everything that's in Lord of the Rings, you can actually find in New Zealand mythology or New Zealand's native fauna naturally anyway. So we had giant eagles. We've got tree gods. We've got magical weapons. You know, it's all here.
And we've even got orcs, and they all live in Auckland.
Well, yeah. Well, actually, funny you should say that because I refer to bikers in my adventure. I refer to them as orcs on motorbikes. And yes, my book does actually talk a little bit about the role of biker gangs in New Zealand. And so I don't completely move away from my roots. But generally what I was trying to do in this book was actually try and find Kiwis out there that actually had clues on how we can beat the fear factory and how we can actually don't have to buy into this whole thing of Fairpool, and we're like, oh my God, 9/11 cell, this is terrible. And all we end up doing is making ourselves anxiety ridden with, you know, with what you do in your own show, Vinny, is you bring in humor a huge amount. And I think that's actually really important because the Wizard of New Zealand, who's he's a satirist, he's a little bit like Screaming Lord Sutch in the UK, but he's got a serious side to him. And he said in his concept of the fun revolution, he's quoting Gandhi, and he says, first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win. Well, if you go straight to the concept of making them laugh at you to begin with, you've already actually moved the first stage of your conflict with them. So you actually, you're a step out of the...
It is, in fact, very difficult to ignore things that make you laugh. You know, but the whole thing about relieving anxiety and tension, I'm just like, bro, I'm not going to stress about it. Things are probably a lot worse than I think they are.
Well, entirely, and you know, I mean, you know, all you do is you stress about it, is you make yourself more fear-ridden, which holds up your ability to see a solution. You know, you've really got to kind of work to keep calm and just, you know, put one step in front of each other. But, you know, even when we look at the human thing, like the thing that sort of recently got New Zealand accolades is one of our ministers, Stephen Joyce, having a rubber dildo thrown at him, which, you know, that went viral and sort of broadcast on CNN and Letterman and the Jon Stewart show. And it shows you how, you know, that sort of activism, which actually lampoons your leaders, actually has more impact upon them when you turn around and you, instead of like, you know, we've got a group, a few activists down here in Dunedin, and wherever they go, the TPPA, there's this group, and they always try and pick fights with the cops, and they're always trying to be confrontational. And of course, what happens is the local media obligingly take photographs of those people. They don't show the other 999 people that are actually law-abiding and just are opposed to something. They take a close-up of these people snarling and looking all aggressive and nasty, and they plaster it on the front page of the newspaper. So when you actually go to do a protest march, well, that photo has just scared away about 1,000 people that would have turned up.
And so, also, the media doesn't interview the actual people who are the speakers at these protests and megaphones and the microphones and that kind of thing. Because I think these media people know that if they interview them, those people will actually know what they're talking about. And so what they do is they randomly try and select the least mediagenic people that they can find, interview a whole bunch of them, and then just pick the worst out and say that this is what all the protesters are like, kind of generally?
Oh, entirely. It's the crazy cat syndrome. They look for the craziest, most malignly lunatic, and then that's the one they zero in on. And it's like recently, you know, again, I end up one of these sort of smaller protests with this clique of people, which I really, you know, when I didn't realize I was going to be there, and I wasn't really comfortable with the way that they were kind of confronting the police. And one of the journalists sort of came up to me and he started talking to me, and I, you know, I've got a degree in political science, and I actually do know about the TPPA, and I said, you know, I'm an author, so I gave him what I considered to be reasonably elegant answers. And of course, the next day when they printed the article in the newspaper, there was no mention about me or the fact that, you know, I mean, down in Dunedin, I run my own publication. I've done it for 12 years, so it's not all entirely like I'm an unknown individual. So they could have turned around and said, you know, here's Ben Vigen, best-selling author, publicist, what he thinks about the TPPA, but they chose not to. They chose to interview the person that was sort of going, oh, this is all bullshit, rah, 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 rah. And of course, you know, that really is going to convince people that you've got a lucid argument when all you can do is throw profanity.
Exactly, because the same thing happened to me at the TPPA protest in Auckland, bro. Media douchebag came up to me and we were like chanting, mainstream media, tell the truth. He's like, well, I'm a member of the mainstream media, it's a big organisation. I'm like, well, dude, just because I'm criticising the media doesn't mean I'm criticising you as an individual. Do you lie? Do you cheat? Do you steal? Do you mischaracterise? And what the hell is that? It sounds like somebody's like practicing a horn in the background there.
It's not me, actually. I don't know where this. I think that's our friends in America.
Well, it's anyway, definitely something that's going. Right on. It's definitely something that's going on outside, and it almost interrupted my train of thought. But not quite, because I talked to him about how if he told and reported the truth about the TPPA, he would soon be without a job. Right? Only the reporters who aren't actually employed, all right, can report the truth about the TPPA. Isn't that interesting?
Well, you know, there's three things there, and I'll work back to front on that one, which is someone actually did a Google demographic search about just to work out whether or not protests were actually working or not, and they discovered that whenever there was a protest, there was a massive surge in people who would go out and search the word TPPA online. But what they also discovered was an actual fact was There were two groups of people. There were ones that would look at the words TPP, which tended to be the wording that was used by government organisations and by the mainstream media. And then there was the people that were looking for the words TPPA, and it appears the activist voice. We're New Zealanders. We always have to add an A on everything anyway. So you know what I mean, eh, bro? But anyway, so what they did was they discovered that people were actually going out. There was this massive surge. They were definitely looking at the words TPA, but they were also looking, more importantly, at the words TPA. So people were actually actively looking for information on the TPPA outside the mainstream media's coverage. And the second aspect about that was, I was talking to a friend of mine, and she was there at the time, and one of our mainstream commentators was there, and she turned around to him and said, well, how many protests do you think at this at the Auckland, the latest TPA protests? And he said, oh, I think there might be 4,000. And as you would have known, Vinny, because you were there, it was probably closer to 15,000.
Closer to 40, said, well, actually.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised, but, you know, she turned around and sort of, you know, pointed out to me how long the traffic flow and worked, you know, some basic logic.
Said, oh, well, can I see, put in the... There's two differences here, though, because there was the start of the blockade and the start of the day. There was approximately 5,000 involved in that, blockading the entire city. And then there is the full protest that happened at midday, which was the length of Queen Street, like a kilometre of people wall to wall. I'd never seen anything like it.
Well, what's amazing was about, you know, and so I'd seen, again, from independent media, I saw those aerial shots and people taking shots from the air, which showed you the scale of it. But when you turn around, I went there home that night and I actually watched the TPA protests on channels 1, 2 and 3. And the first thing that struck me was how often they were not doing air shots that actually gave you a full scale of the protests. And everything that was done, the way they were shooting their shoot angles, and I do a bit of film work, so I know you don't do this accidentally, was designed to actually limit so people on home watching it couldn't actually see the full scale of the protests. And the third thing about this whole media aspect of it is that, which again goes in one of the things I brought up in the book, I just come back from Northland and I met up with you up in Auckland while I was sort of, you know, completing my trip journey. We went to, you and I ended up covering the John Banks trial down at the High Court along with the rest of the mainstream media. And when we got there, there was Saban Brook, who's one of the TV3 reporters, and he was
Brooke
going,
Saban,
oh,
yeah. He's the son of the National Party member Mike Saban, who's allegedly going to getting accused of like sexually assault or something like that. Yeah. I don't know the full story.
Well, exactly, and you know, here he was. Brooke Saban was being very derogatory about you, Vinny. But you know, whenever they show these stories that he does on television, which included the John Banks trial, which included things related to his father, nobody in media land tells you, oh, by the way, this is actually the son of a National MP who has actually been kicked out of office and caused a by-election because of his criminal actions. I mean, you know, that, to me, it shows you, demonstrably, how biased our media is when they can't even tell you the fact that the person reporting the story has a direct conflict of interest and shouldn't be in that position.
Well, you know, if we confronted them on the street, he wouldn't get very much good answers. He'd probably just turn into a babbling brook of some kind.
Well, I mean, that's exactly what they do. I mean, we've seen that firsthand. Again, like, you know, we saw on the day we were interviewing John McCready, which was New Zealand's
Graham
first...
McCready.
Graham, thank you very much. We were interviewing Graham McCready, who's New Zealand's first private prosecution. I mean, it's a landmark moment in New Zealand's legal history. And yet, you know, the questions that they're asking him were, they're saying, well, you know, Graham, you know, what did you have for dinner tonight? And I see you wearing a suit. And, you know, that, and at the end of it, there's a picture in my book of you and me standing on the behind camera on TV3 when we turned up. And there's a whole ring of journalists, you know, and we were very much, in terms of seniority, at the lower end of the rank, yet we were able to get Graham and sit down for him. And I think did an hour-long interview.
A good 20 minutes, I think we have on that. And for those of you who want to actually watch that video, go to go to YouTube and just search Vinny Eastwood Graham McCready or Ben Vigen Graham McCready. It should come up with the result. There is a very, very eye-opening one, that one.
Very, very eye-opening, and, you know, and especially when you look at the questions that we asked them, and then you try and do a search online, you do a comparison, you won't find anything out there in mainstream media that asks any of the questions or brought up any of the issues that we raised, which were, I think, very poignant, and we did a very sophisticated piece that we should be proud of. Yet, that's what the media should have been asking, but nobody actually was. And so that's sort of part of the problem, what we're up against in New Zealand, with this whole issue of people going, well, what can I do about it? The media doesn't report the situation. But, you know, when you go out there and you start running around New Zealand, you find all these amazing people like yourself like Aaron Moore down in Raglan Radio. You've got myself down here. People that are independently doing mainstream, doing media coverage, and getting these amazing hits and results that people from in the mainstream world are coming to us now to look at our news because they're fed up with what they're seeing on mainstream media. And it gives you reason to have hope, and it gives you reason to be inspired because you realize actually there are people out there doing their best to, you know, to confront these issues that we're up against.
Well, the issue we're up against is there's the asleep population. The second thing that we're up against is the population that have woken up but don't want to get out of bed yet and do anything about it, you know?
Yeah.
All right. I'm just in a very upset mood today. Do you ever wake up one day and you're just kind of, you're kind of over it? You're kind of over people's stupidity. You're over people's negativity. You're over basically just the scumbaggery of it all. It's like you see it very clearly, and you're very kind of unhappy that very few other people do, and especially unhappy about the fact that they give you shit about the fact that you see something clearly when they just don't because they're not looking, right? You know, those days where for some reason you just want to smack people who are pissing you off instead of just ignoring them like you should.
Well, I think that's, Vinny, pretty much what happened when I ended up writing this entire book, because, you know, that's the point. Is I had got to that stage. I had got to that stage of having a really good record of being correct and yet still being treated by people like I'm an idiot, people who are jealous of what I'm doing, trying to pick up what I'm trying to do, seeing these things which were obviously, to me, obviously glaringly wrong, but nobody wanted to talk about it, and going, you know, I'm this is making me physically sick. What can I actually do about it? So what I found the best thing to do was that, you know, first of all, traveling, it gave me a little bit of distance, which just allowed me to give it a bit of perspective in it. But then along the way, you know, what I started to come to the conclusion was, number one, is it doesn't matter if you've got 1,000 people asleep, if they are fairly mediocre people that are only going to do the very minimum they can do. If on the other hand, if you've got 1 in 1,000 people who's awake, who has the skills and the drive and the ability, they can make just as much impact as those 1,000 people. But then if you start networking those these, you know, what I call rangers, because again, I keep making all my references to Lord of the Rings. If you can find these rangers and start interconnecting them up, suddenly you've got a very powerful network of people that are not only awake, but they've got the means and the understanding of how to tackle the fear factory of how to tackle this level of corruption which pervades our entire globe.
I was thinking that there needs to be a replication of the awards ceremony type, you know, the fawning that they do over Hollywood celebrities and politicians and all of that kind of thing. I was thinking about not so much fawning and what have you, because, you know, activists don't dig that kind of stuff, but an awards ceremony, all right? I got this camera that I bought, and it turns out that it doesn't work. You know, I mean, not for my purposes, not for my purposes anyway. And I was thinking, what if it got encased in a kind of box of epoxy resin, right? Like it's actually done in there, and it's mounted, and every year we put another little golden shield on it or something like that, and engrave somebody's name into that thing that was stuck on the base there, and then that activist keeps it for a year, and then the next year at the next activism awards, that person who received the award that year gets to pass it on to the next activist.
I think that's, you know, that's a very good idea, and it's something that I guess where I'm coming from is that by having those things which actually applaud us for what we're doing, it gives us some motivation to keep doing what we're doing. And there are people that do need – I mean, this again, there's so many people out there that's my only problem is there are so many people I'd want to give that award to, Vinny. I mean, there are so many people out there that really do an amazing job. And, you know, I mean, the list just off the top of my list, you know, I was speaking to people like Kevin Stoney Burke down on Bluff, who's building a walker, which he's, you know, wants to teach kids how about the environment and how to say please and thank you. There's people like Councillor Alexa Forbes, who's in Queenstown, and she's, you know, she's the one that comes with the idea about it's about finding these small victories, where you're up against these bureaucracies, it's achieving what you can. Her whole thing is about sustainability and packaging. There's people all throughout a whole bunch of people out in Nelson who have learned that, you know, art is a powerful thing and growing community food is a really good way of countering violence. People up in Wairarapa who, again, are doing the same situation but also going into schools and teaching kids how to grow food and how to learn about food themselves. There's people like Rick Thorpe up in Ragland who's teaching entire communities not only about how to food, but how to deal with waste. And Aaron Moore, who's doing documentaries. There's yourself up in Wellington. There's Penny Bright, John Minto. I mean, the list goes on and on and on of these amazing heroes out there that actually, you know, that they give up a lot. And I mean, the reality is, I know myself, if I played the game properly, I would be on $75,000-$80,000 a year. And it's not that hard to do, but it required me having to ask really stupid questions and not cover stories which I knew morally were wrong. And I couldn't do that. So life financially can sometimes be very frustrating for what I'm doing. I never quite had the resources to do what I want to do, but because of the people that I meet, it's very, very enriching. And that's, you know, the thing is, for every person out there that puts the boot in and tells me that I'm a dickhead and all the rest of it, you know, I also know that there's an incredible list of people throughout New Zealand, as you'll see when you read the book, who for some reason or another seem to think that I'm not a complete moron and go out of their way to help me and support me in whatever capacity, whether it's putting me up for the room or feeding me for the night or, you know, helping me get my book printed. And again, those are the things which, you know, when you're getting kicked, booted down, you've got to remind yourself that you've got to count your blessings and remind all the people out there that do what they can. And you can't expect everybody in the battle to be the general. Sometimes you've got to be the general. And really what you're trying to do is teach people how to lead themselves. But it's a slow process, and sometimes people can only give what they want, or they're just starting to wake up and they're just starting to learn the ropes themselves. So you've got to be a little bit patient. You've also got to understand that the battle that we fight today, it's an ongoing one, and it's going to go on forever. You know, there is no one day raising the flag, yay, we won. You know, this is the battle of the human race.
This is exactly what I'm talking about, and this is part of the reason why I was actually so angry today, is because I'm getting into arguments online about people saying, this is it, it's all over, we're going to win, and I'm just like sitting here with like 8 years of going to public meetings and protests and seeing all sorts of shit and all sorts of people make those exact same claims, and I'm just telling them to calm down and give it a minute, you know, because this is what you do is you fizzle people out with hope. Okay, you feed people hope, all that really happens is you actually lead them into despair. All right, now despair is actually where people need to go at some point, because if you do not despair over how horrible things are, if you do not despair about your own situation, the situation of the people that you love, everybody that you meet, at least once in your life, then you're really, really not getting it, bro. Okay? You need to feel how bad it is. Yeah, exactly. And you were talking there about... I was thinking this before the show, and I this often happens sometimes. A thought will come into my head, and I don't know exactly why I'm thinking it, but a conversation will happen, then I'll realize why. What I was thinking earlier today, how many dollars an hour will it cost to make you give up your integrity? How many dollars an hour will it cost for you to give up your destiny?
Okay? Well, I guess
everybody's got to ask themselves that.
Well, you know, I mean, I think about it, like when I was 24, I had a job working for Westpac Research Division, and I had the glorious title of called Research Officer, and I was being paid $34 Australian an hour to take the title of Research Officer, which actually consisted of me taking off stickers off one folder and sticking them on another. That's all I did all day long, and I got paid $34 an hour to do that, and I had to give up that job because it was just doing my head in terms of not only was boring as hell, but I was sitting around looking at this entire system and realized the entire system was geared up to make it so that people didn't ask questions or pay too much attention about what was going on because they were being paid to be comfortably numb. And I remember one stage talking to my boss, who's a really lovely guy, and we were talking about this little kooky little bookshop between us and the stock market down the road in Sydney. And I was saying, you know, George, you know, I'm watching these people come in and out of this bookshop, and there's either punk rockers, people like myself, you know, got safety rings in the ears and, you know, looking a bit disheveled, or there's these bankers with their, you know, Cartier watches and Armani suits coming out with huge stacks, but they're the same books. And I said, what's happening there, George? He said, look, Ben, it's really, really simple. There are three types of people in the world. There are people at the bottom of the food chain who know what reality is because they're the first to feel the boot on the back of their neck. There's the people at the top of the food chain, like myself, at least that's how he perceived himself, people like myself who make their living by knowing what's going to happen next, and that's why we're at the top of the food chain. But the vast majority of human people are people who make their livelihoods by not asking questions. Most of the people are actually getting by in life by the status quo and that cognitive dissonance of being asleep and not being awake.
if it comes down to this, right, we come down to an ideological struggle. And I've been thinking about this a lot lately, because every single government that has ever existed on Earth has committed atrocities in the name of doing the greater good. Yeah. And I'm starting to wonder, you know, why is there this belief in it? What has happened to humans? And then it just clicked for me, bro. It's school, okay? When you're in school, you're in the herd mentality. You're sleep deprived. You get punished for asking difficult questions. So eventually, not only does your wanting to ask a question slowly disappear, your curiosity itself is sure to follow. And what follows after your questioning and curiosity has been eradicated? Your creativity. And then the only thing that you're left is a shell of a person that has essentially no destiny, because you don't have the ability to figure out what that is.
Well, you know, Vinny, it's really funny that you should say that. I mean, I think it was Transvision Vamped at the line. They said 20 years of day school to make you work the night shift. But, you know, the reason why I think it's funny is that one of the things in this book that I write about is I'm getting over a relationship with a person that I really, really had a huge admiration for. And towards the end of the book, you know, I'm sort of kind of dealing with this whole issue about, you know, once you have to move on and learn to find your place in the world, you know, what works and what doesn't. And I talk about something that my ex-partner, who in the book I refer to as Squirrel, said, and I talk about squirrel power, and it's this thing of the early origins of punk rock in New Zealand, not necessarily the UK or the New York story, but punk rock in New Zealand was a really powerful thing that happened. Was suddenly this exposure to this incredible sound had people who traditionally might not necessarily come from the hoity-toity side of the tracks. These were the people that drank beer out of a bottle and, you know, were sort of working class. Suddenly for this music exposed them to a whole level of culture, which suddenly made them realize that, you know, you don't have to be brought up in a certain part of town to be able to read books, to understand poetry, to go to the theater, to appreciate culture. So suddenly these people got really, really excited, because they learned that they could also be clever, smart people themselves, and they gave themselves permission to do that. So then they started getting themselves involved in creating New Zealand's own punk scene, which in Dunedin is, you know, it's famous. It's called the Dunedin Sound. So they had all these, you know, people from a working class background suddenly getting up on stage, and it didn't matter whether they could play three guitar strings properly or they couldn't spell a word properly. The point was they got excited and passionate about actually having something to say, and because they were having so much fun in what they were doing, other people were going, wow, that's amazing. You know, I want to be part of that too. So suddenly you had this entire movement of people that were actually getting in there and actually having something to contribute about the community and realizing they had the right to say it. And this was a very powerful time in New Zealand's history, all the way up until the 1980s. Fast forward today, one of the things that's come along that's undone it is that media and slightly has turned music into being just an entertainer. Its role as a traditional role as a bard and as a unifier of people has been slightly pushed under the carpet. But also suddenly people have let that fear creep in, and they're going like, oh, but he's not playing that musical instrument properly, rightly. Oh, he hasn't put a comma in the right place, or he can't spell a word in the right place. So suddenly people get afraid that they're going to be criticized, so they start to shut up and they end up going right back to where they were to begin with. But it's that whole concept of actually having enjoying the fun of what you're doing, that fun evolution of saying, I'm allowed to say something and I'm going to have fun doing it. It's a very, very powerful tool that we need to remind people about. And that's why I think music is an incredibly important part of that, and the arts at the same time.
Well, it's also funny that you should mention it. See, this is how our conversations sometimes go on air, ladies and gentlemen. I was just at the Splore Festival, a three-day eco festival, right, on kind of like sacred land and like leave no trace. Everybody take everybody their trash away. Very little violence or crime or anything. But myself and two of my mates, we got assaulted by these two young gentlemen who tried to steal my mate's bag. But what are the chances that they would steal our bag out of a dance floor, and then we find those exact guys right outside the bar and grab the bag back off them less than a couple of minutes later? Right, there's something weird in the air going on there, because I never heard anything like that. It was good because my camera and tripod were in there too. What it really kind of signaled to me is that whole togetherness sensation, that we were there and we were doing it and we were having fun and there was great music going on and there were workshops and there was art and there was recycling bins everywhere and this kind of thing. actually changed the vibration field. All right, that's about as close as I can really say. There's so many people who are on such a similar positive vibe that you could almost not help but feel and be changed by that vibe in an instant. What we lamented about this great event is, why can't every day feel like this? All right, it wasn't to party every day and do that kind of thing. Why couldn't we feel this sensation of people being together and people having a good time and not being dicks all the time?
The funny thing is, what I noticed when I was traveling around doing my book, Ben's New Zealand, was I would wander into two different types of community. Community A, which Raglan is a perfect example, was these were healthy communities where you'd sit there having a cup of coffee, just, you know, people watching, and you'd see people moving around and they're being polite and deferential to each other. Everyone was having something to do, whether they were an artist or, you know, working in a cafe. People were proactive. You saw very little graffiti, or the graffiti that you did tend to see tended to be artworks on murals on the sides of places, which was there designed to beautify the place. You found there were methodologies being put in place to deal with waste from telephones to your coffee cups. Basically, you found successful communities which, when they worked on sustainable methods and they were encouraged to believe in their own power and their own potential, they were brilliant places to be. But then, you know, I went from Raglan on one day to suddenly I'm dumped in Manawira on a Friday night on which is South Auckland. On a Friday night, and on that particular moment, while I was waiting for a bus, I think I was offered drugs like no more than 5 or 6 times. I've never seen so many cop cars in all my life. People were running around up and down in the streets, screaming abuse at each other. I looked around, and I, unlike Raglan, which has none of these, all I could see was McDonald's and Burger King's and warehouse franchise shops, all selling made in Chinese stuff. And I was turning around to one of these guys who was trying to sell me drugs. I said, you know, out of curiosity, you know, what have you actually got? He says, oh, bro, you know, I can get you anything you want. And I said, what have you got on at the moment? So, oh, we've got synthetic cannabis and we've got normal cannabis. And I said, well, you know, what are they cost? He said, well, synthetic cannabis is $35 New Zealand and normal cannabis is 25. And I said, so you're telling me that the synthetic stuff, which is really nasty, horrible stuff, it's like glue, if that's selling for actually more than the real deal. He said, oh, yeah. I said, well, why is that? He said, oh, bro, it gets you wasted. And I looked around and I realized that everything about this community was, no, people didn't want to be awake. Everything was so horrible and depressing and took away all their sense of power, that all they wanted to do was be out of it, so then they didn't actually have to deal with it. But wherever you saw places which actually empowered people, that was the opposite. People weren't actually that interested in doing any form, whether it was drugs, alcohol, in a ridiculous – if they were doing them, they were doing them to celebrate, not to commiserate.
Now, earlier today, it dawned on me, or at least there was an article saying that there's going to be a Survivor New Zealand television series being filmed here, and I thought, you know, obviously they're going to film it in South Auckland. I mean, fuck.
Well, the amazing race, it would last very long because their cameras would get stolen in 15 seconds.
That'll teach you with your television franchises.
But, you know, I mean, I joke, but at the end of the day, there were good things in those communities as well, but they were a contrast, showing you where you get one community where people actually work together and they're taught to actually believe in themselves, then great things can actually achieve. And, I mean, Raglan's got, like, you know, they were doing things like cleaning up the waterways, and I've never seen this happen anywhere else in New Zealand. They had the fishermen involved, you had the dairy farmers involved, you had the tourism operators involved. So you have people that normally have interests that conflict each other. But in this case, because they'd create an environment where people could actually sit down and listen to each other's points of views, they were able to find a common ground. And from that common ground, they were able to come up with a solution which actually turned a really polluted waterway into one of the cleanest waterways in New Zealand. And this is the story that you were finding in Raglan time and time and time again. And so, you know, this is what I find. As much as it's depressing, it's, you know, you take the 20 or 30 people that I would have dealt with in Raglan, what they could achieve if you gave them a tenth of the resources and dropped them in a place like Manawira for a year, I'm pretty sure that you could achieve a lot. Unfortunately, what we do have quite often is the people that are the gatekeepers won't allow themselves to think outside the circle because, as I said, you know, as before, they make their money by maintaining the status quo and going along with what we've always had because that's what supports the power system, and that's why we keep getting our power gets centralized. Every decade, it gets more and more entrenched. We go from 90% of the wealth in the hands of 10% to 95% in the hands of the 5% to now we are literally the mainstream, even the mainstream media recognizes this, that 99% of the media of the world's wealth is in the hands of 1% of the population. And it's not going to be until that remaining, you know, people of that middle class go to their cupboards and open the doors and realize they've got no food, will that anybody confront the system? And that's my worry, is why we sort of do need to wake up to the situation. Is, you know, you can have all these really amazingly empowered, clever people, but if the other side's still got 99% of the weapons, it's kind of hard to defeat them. And that's why we really do need to kind of start doing everything we can, because we don't actually have that much time.
I believe that there's a big brainwashing thing going on. Like, you can't set up a system this corrupt and this bad and this obviously corrupt. Like, you can scratch the surface for 2 seconds and start to find out things that are worse than the lies that they've been telling you all the time, right? And soon, the only job that's left will be taking things from people who've got nothing left to give. You know,
well,
we get into this kind of resistance methodology, right? Oh, I'm going to resist them. I'm going to resist them. Yeah, bro, what are you going to do? Start a shooting war against the arms manufacturers? You freaking idiot, you know? Well, the last thing I just wanted to mention was about choices, right? I had this argument with somebody, and I said that the largest portion of human choices don't actually exist, okay? For example, I have a whole bunch of different choices that are available to me that might not be available to other people because my dad was a entrepreneur, millionaire. My mum was a poet and a nurse, etc. I mean, just where you're born, full stop, that influences your life massively. And then we think about these quote-unquote people in South Auckland and all the quote-unquote disadvantaged people. And you think about my life and how I have so many positive influences that I can draw upon, people who are smarter than me and better than me and everything. And then I talk to people and they say, oh, but all those poor people, they made their choices and everything. It's like, no. They've been given limited choices because the amount of positive influences in their life in amidst the McDonald's and the Burger King and the loan sharking shops and the warehouses and the manufactured Chinese bullshit products that break the first time you buy them and all the junk news that they sit down and watch on TV and all the stupid television programming that keep them distracted from reality and the bottle shop on every fucking street corner. And you tell me that these people have got just as many choices as you? You know?
No, they don't.
And they don't.
You're completely, yeah. And that's in the movie, The Boys in the Hood, you know, the hoodie points out exactly the same thing, and he's showing his young son. He says, you know, this is in downtown urban America, and he's showing him the gun shop on every corner, and it's the alcohol shop right opposite. And this is what you get again. You're right, completely right, in South Auckland. This is bombarding of basically role, and I use that word very loosely, role models about the real man, what you're meant to grow up to be. And it's incredibly, this is constant programming of self-destruction. So it takes an incredible character to actually see through that and come out the other side. And it's, you know, I mean, in my book, there's these two characters, you could say, for want of a better word, goody and baddie, but it's not, because there are actual no villains in my book. But one is my ex-partner, you know, Squirrel, and I miss her and all the rest of it. But, you know, she had a very she's got a story which I try not to tell too much of in the book because it's her story, but she was a tough girl, and she came out of the whole thing without any sense of maliciousness, whereas the other partner I ended up having also maybe didn't have as many breaks, but in the end, her fear kept her to being a person that destroyed relationship after relationship after relationship in a very destructive, nasty ways, because she couldn't get herself to find a way to beat that fear, and she held on to it. So the reality is you can come through it, but and you can get to the other side, but at the same time, it is an issue of, you know, I'm lucky. I come from a situation very similar to you, Vinny. Like, my dad is a very successful businessman. My mum is a very clever and creative artist. So these were the tools that I was equipped. So, you know, as a self-publishing publisher, I'm able to use my father's skill sets to do the logistical side of things, to make my books and my papers and my programs happen, and then tap into my mum's side to express myself. And so I'm very, very lucky. But a lot of people don't actually have that advantage. And that's, I think, another aspect, important part about the whole thing. It's like, you know, when we look at New Zealand with the TPPA, there's, you know, there's two things going on there, which is, one was we have a increasingly every year we're having these military exercises where every year more and more American soldiers turn up, and every one of these exercises is about counterterrorism, and the whole story is basically about, you know, somewhere along the line in this script they're going to see us actually fighting them, and that's because that's how their mindset works. But as we proved with throwing the dildo incident and the things that we're talking about, we don't. If we go down that way, and we get ourselves sucked into going with what we're told is the real way to deal with violence, be a man and be violent back, we're going to lose. We're going to get our asses served to us on a platter. But if we can actually use our brain power and actually use those very successful strategies, and we can say they're successful because they were employed to great results by people like Mahatma Gandhi and Martin Luther King, just to name a couple. We can actually turn this completely around, but the trick is not to buy into this fear and buy into the fear for, and as you said, you know, great, you've got to fight an arm, people that manufacture arms with weapons. Good luck. How do you think that's going to work out? When they've decided that they don't want you to win anymore, they'll just cut your trail.
And we have that kind of it's a simplistic reaction, okay? And this is something I had to learn, and in fact, I've only really come to grips with it in the last year or so, after about maybe 8 years of activism, that it's not so simple. There isn't just a silver bullet. There isn't just a, oh, it's going to be solved all of a sudden. Just imagine for a moment that your life has a purpose, and there are many people throughout history who fought their entire lives for the purpose, okay, that they instructed themselves to do. Yeah, these people like Gandhi and so on and so forth, right?
Yeah,
so ladies and gentlemen, baby, please, just listen to me, okay? If you're going to commit yourself to something that you think is really, really good, really commit yourself. It's not going to be a weekend retreat, okay? This is going to absorb your life into it, and you're going to have to create new social circles. You're going to have to create a new way of living so that you can survive what you want to do, okay? This is a damaging, painful, and extremely tough life that you may have just found that you're choosing for yourself. Don't go into it blindly, is all I'm saying.
And you're completely right, and it's not for the light-hearted. And if you, and, you know, depending on the more you take on, the more serious it gets. And you know, if you're at the level where you and I are, yes, there are lots of people out there giving pats on the back and support you and so on. But you will also have entire swathes of society treating you like you're a social pariah. There will be people that will be constantly chipping away at you and making you feel like you're an idiot for doing the right thing. It takes a lot of endurance to do this, but and that's the situation. You're right, Vinny, it's not a weekend retreat. You do this, you're doing it for life, and you're not going to wake up one day and there'll be the victory flag flying over the palace. You know, that happens in Lord of the Rings. In real life, in the real Middle Earth of New Zealand, you're actually laying down a foundation for the next generation. And if you've done a job, if you've done your job even half successful, then you'll leave a seed for them, which they will then pick up and go on to the next level and the next level. And that's all the activists, there needs to be a real change and shift in our thinking, that we are not trying to make the world a better place today. We are simply laying the foundations for it to be a better world in the future. Now, it is a long-term thing.
It reminds me of this speech in the movie Serenity, written by Joss Whedon, the guy who did the Avengers, right? And he said something along the lines of an argument about freedom versus tyranny, right? And the guy who's all about freedom is talking to the tyrannical guy, saying, you know, you want me and all of my people to lay down and die so that you can live in your perfect world. Then the tyrannical guy actually says something very interesting, which I actually quite identify with. He says, I'm not going to live in that perfect world. There's no place for me more, for me there. No more than there's a place for you in it, all right? And
that's right, yeah, yeah.
It's about that kind of the old, the elder Greek philosophy about planting a tree that you know you'll never be able to enjoy the shade of.
Well, I think you're right, and you know, I don't actually mention this in the book, but it is my own philosophy. There's that saying that says that the meek will inherit the earth, and I'm not a particularly biblical person, but it's one that actually I do believe in, because I think there's going to come a time in our history where we're going to face some really trying times, and the vast majority of people, and that's you, me, all the good activist people I've met around when it happens in my time frame, we're not going to be the ones that survive. It'll actually be the people, I believe, in deepest parts of Australia, the ancient Aboriginal people, the Bushmen of the Kalahari, these very ancient cultures that still have their ability to live alongside Earth. All we're trying to do is lay down some seeds so hopefully a few people will learn a little bit from what we have and learn a lot from what they have, and the human race will carry on. But you know, everything we're doing right now, it's a momentary, it's a blink in the moment. Even these guys on the TPA, the 1%, they're thinking in their terminology, you know, I'm creating a dynasty for me and my family. That's nothing. You know, in 100 years, we'll look at this part of history and we'll sort of look at us and go, what the hell were we thinking?
Of course, we won't be there. You know, it's just...
No, we won't.
What was it saying? You can't... I just wonder about this as well. What's the purpose? What's the point? Because I was just thinking about this, that instant gratification model that we've got here. You don't dedicate yourself to something like freedom or truth expecting to get money and praise out of it. I mean...
Well, you know, you take one of the guys in my book, when I turn around and I'm, you know, trailing around, was I spent a bit of time in Taranaki, and the two great heroes that I took out of that was, one was Parihaka, which was the village of Parihaka, which in the early part of the late part of the 1800s, the Crown troops stormed and basically burnt this group of pacifists, their tribe. They burnt it to the ground. They sent the people that were in Parihaka, they sent them down south. They built all the roads from Dunedin out to the Albatross colony, where they built a big revolving gun because they were told that the Russians were going to come in. And in fact, there were no Russians. That was completely fabricated, but the armament manufacturers had worked out that if they didn't have something to scare the people with, they were going to run out of money. So they concocted this big Russian scare so that the people keep on giving them money. So they built this huge road with manual labor, slave labor from the people of Parihaka. They built, and you know, these guys were put in caves at night time, and 85% of them died of pneumonia and various other European diseases, to build this high-tech gun for an enemy that was completely made up. And so you have people like the people of Parihaka and what they were doing, and then people like James K. Baxter, who had also lived in Dunedin, and he founded the commune in Whanganui, Jerusalem. James K. Baxter's father, Archibald Baxter, had been a conscientious objector during World War One. And if you read his book, autobiography, Field Punishment Number One, you realise, you know, the absolute barbarism that his father was endured. So James K. Baxter had come back, had grown up listening to his father's story, watching World War II happen, you know, after where they'd all grown up, being told that World War I was the last battle of all battles, and there'd be no battles after that. So he grew up knowing that, the poems I put in my book was actually James K. Baxter's story about Gunner, which is about a New Zealand soldier sent to fight in an American war in Vietnam. So he grew up knowing that there were always going to be wars, and there was always going to be this culture that taught us how to be real men, of people that, you know, saw violence as heroic when it's not, it's just cowardly. And yet all these people, they did everything they did because they believed in the long-term payout. They realized that it wasn't something that you click your fingers and there was going to be a revolution tomorrow. That fun evolution was a process that was going to take a long time, and that people had to be reminded along the way of what they were doing and why they were doing it.
Well, it's just, it comes down to that whole false flag principle, which is just, looking through history, it just happens all the time, isn't it?
You know? Oh, yeah. False flag, you know, exactly.
They're pretty simple, okay? You just create a foe, you overblow the potential threat that they face. So let's say New Zealand wanted some oil from the Middle East or something. It could start up a story and say that Yemen, for example, has created a genetically modified anemone that they're actually got in New Zealand waters, and
I'm going to stop you there, Vinny, because I'm going to actually give you the real New Zealand false flag about how they're going to play this game out.
I just want to get this joke out first.
All right. Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, Yeah, why to get in the way of a good joke?
Yeah. So you overblow the threat and you say that Yeomans created these genetically modified anemones and they're actually a really big threat to New Zealand fisheries, that they're eating up all our fish and everything like that and collapsing our economy. So overblow this real or imaginary threat and then you use it as a justification to go over there and blow them up and take their resources when there was never any enemy Yemeni anemone.
I saw that one coming. All right, Vinny, you're completely right. And that's exactly what, you know, what's happening in New Zealand. Along the way, as I'm trying to write this book, which is largely, generally speaking, a good news story. I'm trying to find good news, but me being me, I can't help spot scumbags when I see them. And along the way, I kept on coming across the gang culture in New Zealand. And, you know, and it started me thinking about a few things which are going on, which is, back in the 80s, I was involved in the military territorials, which is like the American equivalent of the National Service. I was involved in counterintelligence. As a result of that, I wrote a book called State Secrets, and part of that was dealing with the armament of the underclasses and the creation of an organized crime, which at that time in 1999 we were told didn't exist. Now, when I wrote that book in New Zealand in 19—well, writing that book, I was writing about the development of gang problems in the 80s. In 1987, we had 600 patched gang members in New Zealand. Now, at the time, America's writing Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco and Firearms were writing an article about the scale of the gang problem in America, and they were worried because they were saying that in the United States there were 600 patched members of gangs in the United States. New Zealand's only 4 million, but yet, even back in 1987, we had a culture, a gang culture, that at that stage could mirror the population of the USA. Today, that population is now somewhere in the vicinity of nearly 5,000 to 6,000 patched members of gangs in New Zealand, which is, that's huge. So at the same time, as this has all been going on, and we've slowly accepted that, yes, there is an arms trade in New Zealand, and there is this organized crime factor, it's been getting heavier and heavier, so that within last year alone, we had the emergence of the biker gang called Bandido arrived in New Zealand. Weren't here, in fact, two, 3 years ago, they weren't here. Bang, within 3 years, we've gone from Dunedin, they weren't here at all, to now they've taken over every single major gang in Dunedin. You've got the headhunters, which when I wrote the book in 2000 or 99, there was only 30 to 40 headhunters. Now today, the numbers are estimated to be somewhere around about 200. You might have seen the bust of the headhunters' headquarters in West Auckland end of last year. They were pulling out of these guys' club headquarters. They were pulling out sniper's rifles. They were pulling out machine guns, body armor. These guys had better armaments than the New Zealand Army and the police combined. And that's what they found at the club headquarters, was only what they found in the club headquarters. You can imagine what would have been, you know, sifted throughout houses throughout West Auckland. So the short version is what you're seeing, the development from all this money, which we all know the money is huge and tied up with the gang culture in New Zealand. I mean, the whole New Zealand is one big washing machine, basically. But what you're actually seeing is development of the threat, which according to the original reports, which I was reading, written by the American think tanks, Frost and Sullivan, working for the US government, and the ones that the same exercises that, and analysts that we were doing in the 80s, is we're creating this problem, which is going to create this crime wave, and I'm using I'm doing that in quotations, that's suddenly going to require the military and the police in New Zealand to have more powers and more armaments. So we've already created the problem, and now the next part of the script is going to be they're going to use it as a justification for taking away more powers and giving the state more powers. And then they, after the turnaround, they come in and they take those things away. All those things that they wanted, what they're really after, which had nothing to do with actually civil liberties or protecting our democracies, but just the reality is they'll end up with more power as a result of this threat they created.
See, it's false flag terrorism and it follows the exact same script. Problem, reaction, solution. Problem, reaction. All right, it's the totalitarian tiptoe. This is how they get all of your freedoms and all of your independent thinking and everything off of you so that they can get away with their scumbaggery, okay? Because if people are thinking and if people are vigilant and people critically analyze the bullshit that they're hearing, they're very, very difficult to fool and especially difficult to go into wars that are not justified. You listen to the Vinny Eastwood Show. This is listener-supported radio. Go to to the VinnieEastwoodShow.com today and start up donating a couple of dollars a month into that KiwiBank or into the PayPal. We are doing it. Not for the money, but because it's the right thing to do, and we don't need any further justification. We'll be right back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the lighter side of genocide. Just because we're being exterminated doesn't mean we can't make it fun. Otherwise, what's the point of being killed? And my very special guest is Ben Vigen from Postman Productions down there in Dunedin, and he's going to be releasing a new book presently. I am so terrible, Ben. I don't even know the name. Was it Ben's NZ? Was it Ben's NZ last time? Was the working title, wasn't it?
We're calling it Ben's New Zealand or Ben's NZ. That's fine. Details are on my Facebook page, which is Postman Investigates, or you can go to my website, www.postmanproductions.org, if you want to actually check out some of my blogs and my social media commentary and my marketing side of things. But what I'm also doing is at the end of March, I actually am going to go around to New Zealand. I'm doing a New Zealand-wide tour. So the idea is that we'll be going to different venues around, and I'll be doing a bit of a visual PowerPoint presentation while I give people a little bit of a blurb about what the book's about, and hopefully do a little bit of entertainment and normally open up to question session. But the general idea about the book is what we're trying to look at is this whole concept of we are living in this world, which whether you talk about interpersonal relationships or the geopolitical sense, where we are constantly indoctrinated to be afraid. And the whole purpose of this fear is to make us feel that we don't have any sense of power. And the whole purpose of this book was going out there and finding people that were challenging that concept and had the courage to believe in themselves and show what they were doing with their lives and how they were making their communities better places by having this self-belief. So, you know, really at the end of the day, is after 20 years of chasing the bad guys, and I've chased some pretty nasty people in my time, I wanted to find something that actually reminded myself why it is what I'm doing and remind myself that there actually are people on this planet that are actually sane and that it's not all doom and gloom.
Well, I see there is a hell of a lot of doom and gloom here, but I think it was Evelyn Gilbert that kind of described this best to me. He said that frontal lobe activity decreases when you're afraid, all right? Because your brain energy and your thinking capacity goes into the reptilian fight or flight. Essentially, you can kill people's ability to think by making them scared of something, which is why scared people do really stupid things, like vote National.
Well, I mean, she's completely correct, because basically what happens is when you get into a fear situation, you go to a battle station, and that ties into the most primitive part of your brain, where your response is limited to limited solutions of either fight or flight. But if you can stay away from that fear response, you've got a wider selection of options and solutions that you can deal with the problem. And it's funny that you should say Evelyn Gilbert, because she's one of these heroes that I was interviewing in Raglan, and she did a blog sometime down the road, and she talked about the role of the Wetiko in society. And for those who don't know, the Wetiko, also known as the Wendigo, is a mythical creature in North American Indian culture, that basically it's a cannibal, and what it would do is it would bite its victims, and if the victims weren't eaten and managed to run away, they in turn would turn into Wetikos that would then become ever hungering, would always be trying to bite other people so that they could resolve their own hunger. So basically, she was talking about was the people that go out there and cause terror or fear to others are actual fact are people that are themselves, you need to look at them as victims in their own right and understand that they're not doing what they're doing because they really want to take your power away. They're just doing it because they themselves are weak people. And if you can understand that, it gives you your best opportunity to fight the fear factory and find solutions to fear and find your inner courage. What I call squirrel power.
Penny Bright, another person on the list
another,
there.
Another, Another great activist, yep.
Yeah, I'd probably say I'd actually put her kind of on the top of the list in terms of New Zealand activism, and it's just by sheer weight of how often she's doing it. Yeah. You know, everybody, a lot of other activists have jobs and stuff like that, and they live on the bones of their ass, but Penny, you know, paid off a 20-year mortgage in 8 years as a welding instructor, and then has spent the rest of the time full-time just activism, so she's got an unfair advantage in that respect. to the rest of us rent payers. But
Penny is an amazing person. There's two aspects things I'd like to mention about her, which is the first is, you know, I saw her being slagged off on the Paul Henry show, and it was a classic example of a neoliberal biased media where they turn around and Paul Henry very briefly turned around and went, "Oh, that horrible woman, Penny Bright." And it was like, first of all, he didn't turn around to the people that he, you know, this is his job, is to inform people as a broadcaster. He didn't actually explain to any of her people about who she was or what she's done for New Zealand or what his issue was. So he just immediately left an impression on people's minds designed to brainwash them. So without you knowing anything about her, they'd already go, "Oh, Paul Henry doesn't like her. Oh, she must be a troublemaker then." But the second thing about Penny is that, you know, most people, and I include myself in this, or at least the smart ones who are long-term activists, you've got to learn there are times when you take yourself off the front lines and you literally give yourself permission to go and have a holiday and just stand down for a bit of time, because at the end of the day, this thing wears you down. And if you don't do that, after a while, you just end up kind of being left with a form of post-trauma. So you've got to take yourself off the front lines every once in a while, charge your batteries, and then get back out there. Penny doesn't do that. She's one of these amazing, ever-ready battery people. She's just constantly on the front lines. And so she's, you know, a person that really, if we had a just country, she should be the one that gets the knighthoods. But unfortunately, you only get knighthoods in New Zealand if you've basically done what the Prime Minister wants you to do, and his scumbag mates who want to make money, and that's all they're interested in.
Yeah, and for those of you in Auckland who might be voting in the upcoming local elections, and you're thinking about voting for somebody other than Penny Bright for mayor, okay, just ask yourself these questions. How many Auckland mayoral candidates received a good citizenship award? Risk losing their freehold home by disputing and refusing to pay rates in a proper way? Wants Auckland Council to open the books as they're required to do by law? Beat the council 21 out of 22 times in court, know more about Auckland Council's statutory requirements than the council does, or promise to do anything about or even mention Auckland's corruption, or have a 30-plus year track record of self-sacrifice for the good of Aucklanders and New Zealand? I can answer that for you. None! Except Her Worship Penny Bright. All right?
And of course, the other thing about Penny Bright that everyone should take into context when they're thinking about this is, you can either choose to vote for somebody that is in it because they're going to make a lot of money, and their entire careers and livelihoods have been basically around about making profit, or you can actually vote for someone who has a 30-plus year track record of doing things never about money, but always doing things because they're simply the right thing to do. So you can vote for the person whose record is vested interest, or you can vote for the person whose record is public interest. It's that bloody simple. It's not rocket science.
But, of course, I have a megaphone, right? And when I was at this music event over the thing, there were times when the staff needed my help, and I helped them, even though they didn't ask for it, right? Like, I'd clear crowds out of the way for their vehicles to come through, etc., right? Now, it's about amplification. If this radio broadcast was shared by every single person who was listening to it live, and then shared on by every single person who's their friend, we might actually make a dent, but people aren't really that inclined to do as much of that part as they maybe should. I don't want to pressure anybody here, but you should be sharing this show, because you know for a fact that we're not going to be able to afford to advertise to get the word out to other people without you actually introducing it to them first for us. Yeah. Okay, we create the product. You actually have to be our marketing team here on the other time, because we spend all our time sitting here making the product and giving it to you for nothing. You understand how that dynamic works? You understand what working together is? You understand what being a part of a community is? You understand what social responsibility is? You don't do things because of the money. You do it because they're the what? The right thing to do.
And it's pretty straightforward, you know. And it's interesting. Like one of the things at the moment, which I'm not making myself very popular with, including actually my in-laws at the moment, is as this TPPA thing's been going along, and I've been instigated about mentioning the constitutional implications of the flag change. I've been implemental about mentioning the full stop, the constitutional aspects of the TPPA. Something which a year ago I was being shouted down by certain factions within the TPA protest movement, saying, "Oh, that's all nonsense," and now is the very thing that people like Jane Kelsey actually turn around and say, no, actually, this is actually, he's right. And when he talks about the constitutional review, that is something that we should pay attention to. Now, what I find really interesting is that, you know, these are things, the people that would turn around and say, no, don't listen to him. He's, you know, that's all nonsense. One of the things I pointed out, and I'm going to go very slowly because I want to make what I'm saying very clear. One of the things that's going to happen in the TPPA is it's going to undermine customary Māori land rights in New Zealand, and it's going to undermine the Treaty of Waitangi. I believe this is very much part of the reason why they want to change our constitution, because if they can turn around and do that, then they're moving away the legality of things which stop them from actually otherwise rendering the treaty over and done with, rendering things like Section 29 of the Magna Carta over and done with. But they're doing these things. But what's happening, what I found interesting was that down here in the south, where the biggest iwi is Ngātahu, they were the ones that were jumping on board the TPA movement, and those guys were actually using it to kind of squash what I was saying about the New Zealand flag, and they were actually flying the fern that John Key loves. So these ultra-left-wing people were right behind the fern. And when I said, well, who's actually saying this? Well, it was David Ellison, who's one of the chiefs of Ngātahu down here, who's very proud of the fact that the fern had been brought into New Zealand's icon by Ngātahu in 1903. So I went, okay, that's interesting to begin with, that you're using this to push something that's actually about Ngātahu, nothing to do with anti-TPA. In fact, it's the opposite. You're trying to crush an argument. So then I started looking a little bit deeper. And I said, well, wait a minute. When you look at the constitutional review, the only iwis that are sitting on the constitutional review, the new Māori court law reform review, ECANT revision, which is basically about privatisation of water, and the flag panel, the only iwi that was present was Ngātahu, only Ngātahu. And this is a tribe that's already actually had its payout from the government. So they rip up the treaty, it means nothing to Ngātahu. But Ngātahu, along with Tainui Holdings and PKW and Taranaki, make massive amounts of money from the dairy industry. And these are the ones that when you go to the board of directors were saying, we support the TPA. The TPA is good for dairy prices and we shouldn't be behind it. And when I was turning around to the people in the protest movement that were saying, trying to drown out what I was saying about the constitutional implications of the flag change, who, when I trace them back to the roots of War Ngātahu, I was saying, why are you not getting your chiefs to speak out against the TPPA? Why are you not getting your chiefs to speak out against mining in this country? And that's when they didn't want to have that argument and started getting all nasty towards me, because they were willing to protest until I pointed out the fact that they were actually part of the process that was going to actually make a winning out of this, and they didn't want to raise that part of the argument to be brought up or discussed amongst with any of the other iwis, and they should have. I mean, I had one of these people, my own relative, tell me the other day that only Ngātahu had the right to be involved in ECAMP because they only were tangata te whenua, which I was going, that's absolutely nonsense. To suggest that this iwi, which is less than three generations claims in the South Island, has suddenly got tangata te whenua when other iwis, which are way older, or hapus, don't get to have a say. That's like, I'm sorry, I don't get behind that, and I don't care what the colour of your skin is. If you're going to turn around and say that only we're allowed at the table and only we're allowed a voice, I don't agree with that. And this is what is also happening in this whole process, is that the whole thing has been set up. If you look at the reforms that they want to bring in, the Māori Law Court reform, is they're actually setting it up. So instead of the Māori culture where everybody gets to have their say in the hui, they're setting it up so only if you're a shareholder, only if you sit on the board of directors will you get to have a say, otherwise you're told to go away. And when you raise that question and you go, wait a minute, this is not the Māori way, this is something that we need to be discussing, suddenly they get nasty and they don't want to have that discussion. And I actually think it's really important that the people in Ngātahu, which includes my own niece, need to be having that discussion, because otherwise if they let this injustice go, it will come back to bite them and it will do something bad to them down the road. It will hurt them. So in their own interest, they need to be having this discussion. Well, they need to find their bravery and face that fear, or the thing that scares them about having that discussion, because otherwise it will hurt them. If they don't face their fears, it will be the demon, not the angel.
Hey, and also just on the grounds of like race and indigenous people, because they're all being shafted under the TPPA, where it doesn't matter which country they're from at this yep. particular junction in time, right? And what I notice is I've interviewed some Aboriginal leaders, I've interviewed some Māori leaders and things of that nature, and what I've found is that there's actually a split between the factions there. In Aboriginal culture, they call the splitters coconuts. All right, they're brown on the outside, but they're white on the inside, or the 9-to-5 blanks. And in New Zealand, I talked to activist Ruben Taipari, and I asked him about the Māori elite, the ones who are actually stealing stuff from their own people and taking things away from them, and basically doing the banker's bidding. And he says, "Oh, we call them kūpapa." And it's just that thing as well.
Well,
because
we get divided over these
lines, even within our own groups. And I started to think about how absolutely important it is to really identify yourself as an individual rather than being part of a group, and do the best for the group of the people as what you can as an individual, rather than thinking of yourself as part of the group and what's best for the group.
Well, you know, one of the things I was having, and kind of must have been, it got kind of a little bit more heated than I perhaps would have liked it, but one of the things I was saying to my sister-in-law about the whole Ngātahu situation is, I said, look, I have my niece, Ruby, who's an incredibly intelligent woman, and she's going to do amazing things in her life, but I want her to grow up, and I want her to understand the story of colonialism, that when she understands that when the Ngātahu people came into the South Island and they did it being armed with muskets, which they then used to wipe out the tribes here and then claim conquest as their right. And then at that point, once they claim the right, the people that had sold them those muskets intermarried into those families to legitimize their land claims, because otherwise the crown wouldn't have recognized them. So you had these patriarchal, what I call pre-TPPA privateers, marrying their way into the elite. And these are the ones today that are now causing the shot, and the other ones, you know, signing up to the dairy industry, and they were quite happy to make the money, and they've all got the right in the names. They're the ones that are causing trouble. But at the same time this was going on, it also involved my other relatives, my own direct relatives, which were Griffiths and the Jardines and the Vigens. We were doing all these terrible things. I mean, my family were quite bad bastards, but I want my niece to understand that her relatives on both sides of her family were doing some pretty terrible things, but also some pretty clever things, so that she can learn the truth about her past and take that with her, as opposed to absorbing a whole bunch of fairy tales that gives her unjustly a sense of moral superiority over other people, that makes her think that she's got some sense of entitlement. Because that's what I don't want her doing, is because that's dangerous. Anybody that believes that somehow they're special or more elite than anybody else is not a person to be trusted in my book.
I actually go through at length, and I'm the only radio show host I know who does this, and tell people not to fully implicitly trust me, to not like say, oh, Vinny's that the good guy, and like to defend me in front of other people if they accuse me of something, and show evidence, you know, actually look at the evidence. Because hopefully, if I actually start doing something wrong, if I turn into some kind of douchebag, if I start using people, if I start talking over my guests constantly, if I start throwing products at you that I don't believe in, etc., you know, expose me. Take me the hell down, because I'm not me anymore, and the me you knew is gone.
But the funny thing is, Vinny, in my book, you know, I write about you, and I say in the book, like, you know, number one is, on your show, you'll have these guests, and they talk about all sorts of concepts of Gender 21 and the Illuminati, and you've talked about aliens and all sorts of weird and wonderful stuff. And number one, you know, some of the terminology that you use, in the lexicon that I use, it's like a fingernail going down a chalkboard. I just go, oh, don't use that word, oh, you know. But you do it deliberately because you want to provoke people into thinking about what does that word actually mean, or what the overall aspect of it is. But overall, what you're doing is you're not putting a platform out and saying, this is the real news and everything that happens in this is the truth. What you're simply doing is you're doing what the media should be doing, is you're giving a platform so that everybody can actually have their voice and present their argument. And if people at the end of the listening to the show, they kind of go, oh, you know, I still don't believe in aliens, or, you know, I think Illuminati's a load of quabbobblers, fair enough. But at least you've given people a chance to understand what these concepts are, instead of simply the 15 seconds they get on the media where they dismiss a word without and go on to the next thing. And, you know, the reality is, we watch our mainstream media, and anybody unless they've had their head cut off knows it's full of so much crap, lies, and half-truths, that when they actually, to these days, when they turn around and go dismiss something like the Illuminati or whatever, it actually almost makes you go, well, it must be true because the media's bagging it. You know, whereas So I actually think that you giving this platform is a good thing. I, on the other hand, I don't use words like Illuminati or Agenda 21 because, to my mind, the words you don't need to use. I can say the 1%. I can say the old school tie, and it still has the same meaning, so people know what I'm actually talking about. So I look for a common denominator. But in your case, you're happy to use all these different terminology simply because you're not trying to speak the truth. You're simply giving a platform for people to present their viewpoints. And if you're doing it so you're presenting it so that you've got everybody, left wing, right wing, the esoteric, the science-minded or whatever, all coming on the platform, then you're giving people an opportunity out there to listen to all of it, and then they get to decide what the truth is. And that's what the media is meant to do. It's not the job of the media to tell you what the truth is. The job of the media is simply to give you information which is presented as honestly and as accurate as you can. And that's what you do. And as long as you keep doing that, Vinny, I don't think, you know, there's ever going to be a problem. There is no need to out you.
Well, I expect not. However, it's always a good idea to remember how bad a person you could possibly be and make sure you go in the other direction. But keep reminding yourself that that person's always there if you want to change back. But you can't. It's like once you turn bad, you know, almost like there's no coming back from that. Like you actually sell yourself. Many of us have done this. We've worked, even though we didn't want to. We've done things that we didn't want to, but we didn't totally sell out. We didn't get tested to the point where we actually had to kill somebody or we really had to hamstring and destroy somebody's life right there many, many times in order to prove our worthiness to the gang or a dark god or some bullshit like that, right?
But the fact of the matter is there are actually people out there, and at least in my world, Vinny, there are people out there that have done these terrible things and have had terrible, terrible things done to them and to others. And they are people who, and I actually in some ways have the utmost respect for, because they are people that have gone, hey, that was the old person. And while I have all these fears and these things, you know, that, you know, to go that far really, really drags you into the pit of hell. To go, well, I have these things. I don't need to be that person anymore. I can face my fear and I can be somebody else. Those are the people that I actually really have my hat off to. And it's, you know, I mean, I look again, I mentioned my ex-partner, and because of the way she is, the end result is she's no longer my life and she's not my friend. And I have every reason in some ways to go be negative towards her. But I also look at all the things that she's done in life and what she's done with them, what she's accomplished. And I understand the way that she is. And for all those things that costs me, I still admire her and I still have absolute respect for her because she has achieved so much in life when, you know, she has every reason in the world in life to be a nasty, horrible person, but she chose to find the part of her which is compassionate and a very lovely, endearing person. And yeah, okay, she's got her prickly bits, but she's still come a long way compared to the person that grew up on the right side of the tracks and never had any challenges. She went through the hardest trials and came out a good person, and that shows you that it can be done.
Well, it just for ordinary people, absolutely, totally 100% agree with you. Psychopaths, no, there's no cure.
Well, and that's the whole concept. I guess in my book, you know, I talk about the fear factor, and I talk about what is a hero and what is a superhero, and I talk about, you know, the bad guys, the soldiers of the fear factory, and, you know, a hero is like what most of us are. We all go through trials and tribulations, and we do things that we're not necessarily proud of. But if we go to bed at night time and we think, you know, at the end of the day, I have never stepped on anybody's seed, I've never acted in a malicious way, then, you know, for all the things I didn't do right, I shouldn't be too hard on myself. I'm not a bad person. And then you get the superheroes, the people that did all those things, but they also conducted themselves in such a way that they left a profound impact on people, which actually inspires people to be the best people they can. And those people, some of them, you know, they're not the names that you and I, you know, they can be, but they're not generally household names. They're normally very normal people that just live their lives in an extraordinary fashion. And then you get the people that actually buy this big pile, steaming pile of horseshit that says that they can't actually be powerful and that they actually have to be part of something, you know, a gang or a police force or a country to have any sense of power. And these are the ones that are so afraid that they just suck up this cock shit, and the other ones actually end up doing most of the harm, when the vast majority of people in life are actually heroes. They just need to be reminded that they can also be superheroes.
I think that does happen. It's the leadership and the examples. However, there's also a particular strain I felt on the left who have become extremely anarchistic to the point where they think that leadership in and of itself, being able to direct, to help, to do anything with groups of people is inherently a bad thing. And yeah, they miss that truth.
But those guys hate my guts, and number one is because, first of all, they're not anarchists. I'm an anarchist, and you know that's what I am. And anarchy is simply questioning authority in all forms, and it doesn't matter whether it's the Maori indigenous culture, which I have a lot of sympathy for, or it's the government. Everybody that comes along and tells me that something, this is how it is, I'm not just going to accept it. I'm going to question. I'm going to look at it. I'm going to pick it up. I'm going to examine it from all edges. Then I'll make a decision. That's anarchy. What these guys have is they are. You know, I always say neoliberalism is a two-faced creature with two sets of wings. It's got a left wing and it's got a right wing. So if you imagine the double-headed eagle of Nazi Germany, that's a classic neoliberal symbol for you, because you find that these people in the far left, they become so afraid of the system, they actually become mirror images of the very thing that they're actually fighting. They become intolerant of anyone that doesn't have a viewpoint that's the same as their own. They are quite happy to cut people down. They'll gang up on other people. You know, they end up basically being little John Keys. And it's quite funny, because when I see these guys at protests and the way that they actually antagonize the cops and try to instigate violence, they're actually doing the very thing that John Key wants. And every time one of those dickheads causes a scene that gets them on the front page, John Key and his mates clap their hands and go, awesome, you've just made that movement that much weaker. Because what these guys can't stand in their egos, because they've got huge egos and they've got to control, they've got to be the leaders, is they don't understand that the thing that John Key really fears at a protest is not some smelly feral person getting aggressive. It's mum and dad turning up to protests with their kids in a trawler. The more of those that are seen on TV, the scarier John Key becomes. So when you do protests, you've got to learn the methodologies of Martin Luther King. And you've got to learn the mythologies of people like Mahatma Gandhi, because these people are doing the very thing that scared the state. And you know why we know they scared the state? Because that's why the state took them out in the first place. If they weren't doing something right, the state wouldn't have had any reason to remove these people.
Or create an entire apparatus to surveil those people 24 hours a day at the expense of $100,000 a week in some cases. Okay,
shows you how brilliant what they're doing. You don't have to learn anything new. You just got to go back to the masters, the Jedi Knights of Peace, who taught us exactly what we need to do. And with that, and with making activism a fun thing that's got music and it's got art in it and it's got food and it's got jokes and it's got laughter. And in actual fact, that's the thing you do. Every prank that you can pull against your enemy, you look at it, every time you do something that makes people laugh, that's what gets activism on television. It's the only time they show you throwing rocks is when they actually use it to make the activist weaker. The thing that actually always makes the activist stronger is it's when someone throws a rubber dildo at a prime minister, or there's a Kermit the Frog moment that makes everyone laugh their ass off, and they appear on Ben Stewart's show or The Daily Show. Those are the things that are the powerful things, and that's why laughter really is one of our best weapons in our armory.
Which is interesting, because psychopaths aren't known for having a sense of humor or the ability to joke around at all.
And that's the thing, is that psychopaths hate laughter. That's the thing. You can get throw rocks at a sociopath, you can chant at him, and he sits there and his ego swirls. He goes, oh, I must be important because all these people are doing this, aren't I amazing? And he gets a real hard on. You turn around and you make them look like a silly twit, and the sociopath just falls to pieces. Because at the end of the day, as Evelyn Kilbert pointed out in a whole piece about witticos, which I borrow and use throughout my book, so credit to you, Evelyn Gilbert, the sociopath is a narcissist, and the narcissist cannot handle being made to look like an idiot. It's the absolute chink in their armor.
I can absolutely attest to that, because I'm a narcissist, and I do not like anybody criticizing me. Very like it actually affects me, kind of like I can't help it. It's actually kind of... do you know what reactive armor is on a tank? Okay, for those in the audience who don't know, you put layers of explosives around your tank so that when a missile comes at it and explodes, the piece of the armor that it hits actually explodes back and takes away the force. And that's kind of what it's like when you're a narcissist and you're getting insulted by somebody. You react just boom like that, extremely aggressively, because you haven't been loved very much when in your earlier life, and your brain remodels itself so that you can love yourself enough by yourself to get by, which means you've got to love yourself maybe 5 to 10 times as much as the ordinary person does.
Yeah,
that makes it difficult to deal with criticism.
And that's what we're talking about before, and you know, the people, those sort of dark monster characters. It's the ones that actually have that. The other ones that I feel the saddest for, because they're the ones that don't actually have the tools that will ever allow them to rewire themselves so that they can actually come out of the dark and wake up. So, you know, I'll still chop the heads off, but I'll do it quickly and as painlessly as I possibly can, because at the end of the day, they are ultimately the weak characters, and they're vulnerable because of that terrible sense of feeling inadequate and not loved. All you have to do to make them, to expose them, is laugh at them, and then they fall to pieces. And that's, you know, I mean, you've got all these like public relations guys out there that spend huge amounts of money making these narcissists look good on television so that we don't see the real them. That's the best way to expose them quickly as possible, is get something that'll actually make them, their mask come off, and then the rest of New Zealand can go, oh, so that's what's on underneath that. Oh, that's a bit pussy and ugly.
See, exactly. What was it? There's an old saying, how do you expose a fascist? By making them act like it.
Yep. Yep. No, that's entirely. That's exactly the thing. Is, you know, and it's what I found was that, you know, I sort of go along, do my trip, and I come across people, and they smile to your face while as soon as your back turns, they cut your hair, and you know, and they'll gaslight. They do a really good job of picking away at you, and you know, going, oh, that guy's a terrible person. And suddenly you find these people are giving you a hard time because of what they've been told or what they heard. And you're going, how do you deal with this? And then you kind of turn it back on them and find some way to actually, you know, show their own
inadequacies.
Inadequacies. So at that point, they lose it and the mask drops off, and everyone's going, oh, actually, we haven't been told the true story. Now we see what's really going on. And that's the thing, is trying to get that mask off people. And it's, I guess, another thing which I kind of raised in this whole thing about the TPA is, and this group that we're dealing with, that's, you know, the ones that are trying to act like they're the activists, but yet at the same time they're trying to control the situation, is I always laugh how many of that clique love to actually turn up to protests, and they do so in the anonymous mask. And the first of all, it's like, when I turn up to protest, I'm proud of it. So there's never any way you're ever going to find me behind a mask, any shape or form. I don't need to be afraid. I'm not doing anything illegal. So the very fact that I have to hide something immediately puts me on the back foot when I'm dealing with people that feel that they can only be brave if they have a mask on their face. But the second thing that really makes me laugh with that whole anonymous concept is, it's like, okay, so get this right. You're at a anti-TPPA, anti-monopolism protests wearing a face mask made from plastic products in a Chinese sweatshop. What's wrong with this picture? You know, it's like, okay, you're advocating an anonymously guy that does violence, ripped off the concept of 1984, where we know in actual fact from 1984, the so-called mask activists were actually working for the government. So anybody that turns up and says, I'm not going to really show you who you are or where my sovereignty, personal sovereignty comes from, I'm sorry, there's no way in hell I'm going to march next to you. You know, I march for people that don't have masks on and say, I'm marching because I don't belong to group XYZ or belong to ideology ABZ. I'm marching because I'm me, and I think that this personally is morally wrong. I don't need to belong to an alphabet soup to actually have a reason to be here.
See, and again, that is the thing. The difference between the individual and the collective, okay? People need to understand, you're not a collective. You're an individual, okay? You're not a forest. You can't touch a forest. You're a tree. You can touch a tree. All right, it's right there. That's the difference. It's the difference between who you are and an abstraction of thought of where you belong. All right, if you are identifying your entire personality based upon an abstraction of thought of where you belong, you're never going to know who you are, because you only identify yourself through the activities of the group, never yourself, never your own activities, never your own thoughts, your own feelings, your own passions, your own ideas, your own entrepreneurial fucking businesses that fuck up and fall over, all right?
Yeah. Well, exactly, you know, own it, and that's the whole thing too. I mean, that's again where I gotta step back a wee bit a second, again. You know, sort of have this conflict with the issue about Natal with my relatives, and like, I'm proud that my niece is Ngātahu, and that makes her, it links to the indigenous part of New Zealand. And I'm proud of the culture and all the spiritualism that comes with any concept of any iwi. But I don't feel, as I feel the same about my own European ancestry, that I actually have to think that somehow this makes me important, or that that is who I am. I'm Ben Vigen. I'm not the son of a privateer who sold muskets to people to carry out genocide. I'm not the son of a grandfather who was the editor of the first Fiji Times. These are all things that my ancestors did that taught me a lot about what was going on in the Pacific, but they're not me. I'm me, and there is only one of me. And at the end of the day, whether I succeed or I fail, that's not, I can't say, well, I succeeded because I've got the might of the Vigen clan behind me, because we're the almighty Vigens and we've got the magic Vigen DNA running through our blood. That's nonsense. I succeeded because I am lucky that I've got good parents who come from interesting, diverse backgrounds that gave me some good tools, and I was brought up with brothers and sisters who are all as competitive as hell, so it gave me drive. And I was lucky enough to grow up in a country at a time where we still had a good education, so I got good education, good opportunities, but I succeeded because of me. I didn't succeed because I belonged to any particular club. And likewise, if I fail, I fail because of my own failings, and that's my own.
Hey, well, this is the reason why really rich, self-entitled, unchallenged people wind up getting into drugs and sex all the time, because they actually don't have anything going for them. They think all that they are has already been granted to them, and they've never had to earn it because it's already been earned, right?
So what's my excuse?
Well, thing is, like, when I was 10 years old, I realized this dynamic, because somebody said to me, oh, my brother could beat up your brother, and I thought to myself at 10 years old, so somebody who isn't you could beat up somebody who isn't me.
Yeah, exactly, you know, and it's absolute nonsense. And, you know, at the end of the day, we actually succeed or fail, but the difference is, there are some people say, oh, you know, what you know, my brother, because occasionally, you know, he's a real estate agent and very successful at what he does, but when it comes to the activism, he says, you know, Ben, why do you bother to do anything? Because, you know, the chances of you succeeding when the world being so completely messed up is pretty slim. And I look at my brother and I say, look, you know, Rhys, you're completely correct, but if I do nothing, the mathematical chances of me succeeding are zero. And now if I try, the chances of me succeeding may be less than the tip of my fingernail, but still mathematically that's infinitely superior to zero chance.
Well,
it's that simple.
Yeah, well, for me...
I can try and do something. Now, this is the next step that comes about, is that people go, okay, well, you know, why do you try? I try because I actually believe that, you know, before you even pick up my book, you'll find there's a typo, there's a spelling, I'm dyslexic, I'm disorganized, I lose phones all over the place. But I also have this passion and an ability to join dots, which is my gift in life, even though I can't, you know, I can fire an automatic weapon, but I can't drive a car, and I've got all these sort of pluses and minuses, but my main thing is my research abilities, and I find stuff that other people can't, and when I put it all together and when I speak about it, I find that I have something about me that actually inspires people to get out there and see what they can do. And I think what I have achieved in my lifetime, I'm very, very proud of what I've done. And if I hadn't tried any of these things, I would never have achieved any of these things. So, you know, to my mind, once you get out and you try, you'll be amazed at what you accomplish.
I mean, I had the exact same kind of realization as well. You know, what are my chances of victory? Pretty slim. And in fact, I actually believe that I probably can't win. However, I have a moral obligation to resist, so I have to.
Well, but that is an interesting concept, Vinny, because, you know, when we say win, I mean, what do we mean by the terms of success? So I look at it this way from your viewpoint. You have been doing these shows now for what, give or take 7 years, thereabouts?
Ish, maybe eight.
Okay, so Okay, 7-8 years. Now, in that time, not only have your YouTube channels at various times and ratings achieved more hits collectively than the mainstream YouTube channels of TV3, MediaWorks, Radio Live, and I think Radio New Zealand combined, and you did that all as one individual, not without a corporate team behind you with technicians. And so you did all that yourself. So that alone is an amazing accomplishment. I'm blown away at that. But
I still have more YouTube subscribers than all of the mainstream media YouTube channels combined. Exactly. Well, the ones that do news anyway. The entertainment ones, they got millions of subscribers.
Well, yeah, cool. I mean, and that's the thing. You're never going to be – but that's always a bit depressing. But, you know, you still succeed. And this is the thing also which, you know, Alexa Forbes says in my book, who's a very lovely woman from down in Queensland, a counsellor. She says, you know, she goes to these council meetings and she's up against these people that are profit-driven, and Queensland's about, it's equivalent, or Queensland's equivalent to like Las Vegas, the United States. It's money-driven. And she only gets, you know, 1/10 of her sustainable plan put in place in Queensland. But she says, you know, at the end of the day, I'll get my nose pointed out of shape, or I can say it's still a victory. Small victory is still a victory. So you've got to actually, when you achieve these things, not get bent out of shape for what you haven't achieved, but actually acknowledge what you've done. Now, the second thing, Vinny, is that not only have you achieved this rating-wise an amazing accomplishment, there are, whether you know it or not, there are going to be hundreds, if not thousands, of people in your lifetime, Vinny, that will be foolishly get sucked into, because they listen to your show, of thinking that they can go out there and actually do their own involvement in the media and become citizen journalists. And that'll be because of your influence. And I know this because this is what's happened to me. I've had people that have got off drugs and have stopped, have not committed suicide and have become journalists, because for all the things that are faulty and flawed in my work, and because I'm doing it on a limited budget, and it's, you know, sometimes it's not the prettiest diamond in the egg packing, it still has made an impact. So those are the things that we need to be very, very proud of and remind ourselves when we're having those bad days. And then the final aspect of it is the final thing is it's that, also that ripple thing, which unfortunately for the kind of jobs that you and I do, we chuck stones in the river and then we walk away. Most of the time, we never even get to see what the consequences of what we are actually doing. But the reality is, you know, I looked at what I was doing with the flag situation. I'm down here and I've got, you know, collectively my radio audience, combined annual audience is about, give or take, between 40 to 60,000 people a year on print. Probably another 20,000 on my website, and I'm lucky. And then I get another 20,000 from my social media feed. So all up, you know, one person at the bottom of the South Island, I have 100,000 people, which is probably about less than 5% of the population of New Zealand. But even though that's the case, I still had a huge impact upon the TPA protest in terms of when we started to talk about things like constitutional issues and we started to discuss the flag issues. And these are things which I'm very, very proud of, because that was me. One single person managed to get that rugby ball, which wasn't being discussed at the time, and I managed to get it on the rugby field, and now people are kicking it wherever they want, and I don't care. You know, I've moved on to the next rugby ball. But those are the kind of things that we've got to understand. This is what we're doing. So we have a lot of success in our life, Vinny, and never, ever, ever underestimate what you're doing, because what you're doing is hugely important.
Oh, yeah, I totally agree. However, I choose to, what was it? The easiest person to lie to yourself, the easiest person to lie to is yourself, right? And I've got this kind of idea that in order for something to be true, it has to have a kind of cosmic irony for it. For example, you do a really great big story and you put a lot of effort into it, but then you just throw it away out for free, and then you walk away and do off the next one and don't actually see any recompense from it. And you see other people upload it and they get hundreds of thousands of views, but it doesn't matter because you're too busy doing the next thing. Now,
exactly.
When I believe I read in a book sometime ago about somebody's motivation for being a teacher, right? And I say, why do you want to be a teacher? You don't get any money, you don't get any other recognition, and blah, 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 blah. And they go, well, because when I was in school, I had a teacher who cared about me, wanted to help me, and actually motivated me to be a better person than I was. And they didn't actually get any recognition. I never even got to thank them for it. However, I know exactly how much impact they had on me, and that's why I want to be a teacher.
Yeah, no, I agree with that entirely. And it's, you know, it is the whole, I mean, I love my father's he's nearly getting to be. I think he's about 83 years old, and he's a hoot of a guy. Like he still races his cars around Bathurst in Australia, and he still does marathons. And he goes out and he surfs in the deep water, and he sits on the beach and purrs with all the pretty young girls. You know, and he's a lovely guy, and the older he gets, the more loving I'm finding him. But you know, sometimes the things that come out of his mouth, I tend to be a little bit. They're a product of the generation which he grew up in, and he'll say things to me like, you know, Ben, yet have you had any money yet? Have you made a buck yet? Have you had a fuck yet? And his entire version of success, the way that he was brought up, all that's changing the older he gets, and he starts to have a more holistic view, is about success is about how much money you've got in your bank account and how many women that are on your arm. My view of success is actually not about how much money I've got in my bank account and how many women I've got on my arm. It's about, A, have I got the right person that's my best mate? And it's success is about the things of going, hey, did I make my world, did I not make my world a better place for me today, but did I also make it a better world for my niece Ruby and for my ex-partner Squirrel and for my brother Reese and for my dad Len? And you know, I go to bed at night time and I think, well, you know, I did a little bit, I did everything I could to do that, then I feel successful. And I think I've actually, you know, I've had a really great life in the sense I've done lots of that, and along the way I've also been blessed. I've got to, you know, I've got to go and eat at some pretty amazing places, having worked in the hospitality industry, met some incredible people. I've gone to some, you know, I've had a pretty luxurious life through working on hospitality as well as a journalist. So I actually, it hasn't been without perks, but generally most of my life's the bits that have always given me that real kind of like, wow, I did that, have been the things that I've done, the changes I've made in other people's lives and society. To me, that is success. If along the way I make enough money so that when I go into my old age that I know I've got medical attention and I'm not a bank drain on someone else, that'll be okay. That would be nice, but it's not the essential thing. I'm actually what I'm here for. At the end of the day, I have a roof over my head, and I've had a pretty good life, so I don't really have a lot to complain about. And I get to do a lot of things, which luckily for all the bad things that happen in New Zealand, we're still a country at this stage where, you know, I get to do what I do. And there's a lot of countries in the world where you would not have a shit show in hell of doing, getting away with half the stunts I pulled.
Yeah, it sounds about right, eh? Because it's just, it gets really crazy sometimes. And I think it was my uncle, he came up to me, and my uncle and auntie don't approve of what I do, but, you know, they're very wealthy, they've worked really hard, you know, they bought farms and car dealerships and things like that. They got three boys that have all gone to King's College, and, you know, he was telling me about my youngest cousin, Tom, who just come out of going overseas and having an OE, and never had a job in his life. All of a sudden, he's saving $5,000 a month for a home, you know, first job that he ever got. And Uncle was like saying, that's quite an achievement, and as if I should be achieving as much. And I said, well, you know, that's really great. And I'm sure he's quite happy doing that. But instead of doing that, I created the largest online archive in New Zealand history of protests, activism, and interviews with activists and journalists and people from all around the world of the greatest minds of our time that has ever existed, and have more subscribers than the New Zealand Herald, right? So, you know, clap for him. That's really great achievement.
Yeah, good on him. And I have no problem with people making them. You know, I'm actually, the other thing which the hardcore leftists, I actually don't have a problem making money. I don't think that this whole starving artist activist thing, I think, is absolute nonsense.
But it's just one of the consequences of telling the truth, because there ain't a hell of a lot of money in selling the truth. There's a hell of a lot of money in selling bullshit, though.
We'll get back to that in a second. But I mean, the reality is, the first two jobs I had when I left university. One was working for Alan Jones and 2U Radio in Sydney, which is, he was Australia's biggest talkback guy, and I was his research officer at that time. I lasted 8 weeks in that job because it required me to tell the biggest bunch of neoliberal lies, and I knew they were lies, and I knew that he knew they were lies. And so that job, which was horrible, I mean, it was a horrible, you know, a huge corporate radio station, and it was like the ickiest feeling that I've ever been, because you constantly were like, nobody would help you in job because they were afraid that somebody would take their job, and it was just a really hideous environment. The money that I was getting paid was actually ridiculously good, but I just couldn't stomach it. So, you know, we left that job and mutually agreed that I wasn't cut out to work for corporate radio. And then the next job was working for Westpac, where, again, I got paid a ridiculous amount of money. I said $34 an hour for a title, a very swanky title, research officer, to put stickers in one folder. Now, if I'd stuck at that job, the reality is within 6 months I would have been accepted into the bank as a permanent. And then if I'd done there for another year, then they would have moved me up to being the research manager, which probably meant that I had some equally boring job but paid actually even more. And eventually I probably would have actually found myself doing actual research but getting paid huge amounts of money for doing it. But the whole thing was set up to vet you, to make sure that they didn't let anybody in the system that didn't actually agree with the system. So basically it was cleverly done to weed people out like myself. And I basically been as a freelance journalist ever since. And I've had my moments of success and I've had my moments of abject failure. And I haven't necessarily made a huge amounts of money out of it, but I've managed to be able to most of the time work for myself independently and tell the stories that I actually want. And eventually what I'm finding, kind of ironically, is as I get more and more towards as I go, a little bit of income is slowly starting to trickle in, and I can see once I get that where I can develop areas. But it's taken a long, long time for it to get to that point. But the reason why I managed to get to that point in the first place was I had a good story to tell, which people responded to. So it did grow. It just didn't grow as rapidly when you're selling the corporate media and you're selling boobs and bullshit. Because as we know, you can have, you know, a YouTube channel which gets zillions of hits for news and outdoes everybody else, but all it has to do to beat your channel, Vinny, is you have some woman painting her nails that she did on YouTube channel that, and they would blitz you probably within a week.
Oh, in minutes.
I know. Isn't that so depressing?
It's just you. Also, it's about setting appropriate goals, okay? Because when I first went out, I was like, I'm going to expose the fact that 9/11 is an inside job. I'm going to convert everybody. And then after a few years, I started to realize that's not going to happen. That's an unrealistic goal. So my goal is, therefore, to just give a platform to people and do that kind of thing. But there's not a whole lot of benchmark to success, because it means every single time I successfully record and publish a show or a video, that is a success, right? So I'm getting constant success on a daily basis. Now, what's interesting about this, and this is the other aspect we haven't really gotten into, is how things synchronistically turn up to keep you on your path, like these little really random coincidences that actually, oh my God, there's my money for the rent for the week. Oh my God, there's suddenly a ride from this location to the other, you know?
But that I'm so glad you raised it, Vinny, because that's in a way what I should have started off from the beginning of, about my whole book. You know, once I actually realized, Once I got myself into a mindset where I stopped worrying about what was going to happen tomorrow, what the anxiety of the future was, all the things that could go wrong, and once I started worrying, feeling hurt about all the things in my past and about things that are unfair and this is terrible, that, you know, I can't get a chance to talk to Squirrel, so she's got a whole bunch of, you know, all these things which you're getting the baggage you're carrying on to. Once I let go of that stuff and I just went with the moment and said, look, you know, where am I meant to be? The universe would reach out and would do the most weirdest things repeatedly, where it would just put you exactly where you're meant to be. Once you let yourself be carried in the calm of that storm, that eye, synchronicity would step forth and it would always give you exactly what you need. And, like, you know, I'm up in Northland, and I decided that I'm going to do this whole focus on the curry trees, which is it's an amazing story, also a very, very sad one. In less than 3 years, virtually every single ancient curry tree will have been shipped, gone from New Zealand, it'll all be in China. Our curry trees, and these are trees that can grow up to, the oldest one in recorded history, it's the oldest one growing right now is 2,000, but they can actually go up to over 11,000 years old. But the government now is not doing anything to actually counter the virus that's killing them off, even though we know you can grow these trees sustainably to make amazing wood for musical instruments and high quality furniture, which fetches an amazing price. So we're not actually doing anything to keep that alive. But, you know, this is a story I wanted to tell up in Northland, and I found myself arriving at this carver's, Kerry Strongman, amazing guy,
And, you know, I'm there and this is what I'm going to focus on. And he starts telling me these amazing stories. And I'm broke at this stage. I'm sort of going, well, just go with the flow. Don't worry about it. Something will turn up. But at this stage, my budget has literally, I've got 50 cents in my pocket. And I'm going, if I don't find some way to make some money soon, I'm going to be in trouble. And I'm talking to Kerry, and this envelope turns up, and he opens it up, and $200 drops out. And Kerry looks at me and goes, what's your budget like at the moment? And I'm like, well, actually, to be honest, bro, it's actually not that great. And he just hands them over. And, you know, I've hopefully done a good job of kind of promoting what a brilliant person Kerry is in the book. But that was an act of absolute generosity and random kindness, which just came out of nowhere because I needed it. But once I just said, hey, man, don't worry about it. You've got this job to do. It's an important job. Something will turn up. It bloody well did, and it does it all the time.
Okay, and that's what doing an important job is all about, isn't it? And that's how you know you're actually doing one.
Well,
wait. Hold on a second. Here's the very, very important realization. And I've got people painting their house at the moment, so that's what that noise is. But here's the important realization, ladies and gentlemen. If you're doing a 9-to-5 job and you're anxious about when you're going to work and how much money you got at the end of the week versus you've got no income, you've got no job, yet you expect that because you're doing the right thing with all of your free time that you've got, that exactly what you need to survive and exactly what you need to pay that week will turn up exactly on the day that you need it and the exact amount you need, okay? Which one of those two people is more free?
Bingo.
All right. You listen to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Ben Vidgen from postmanproductions.org has been my guest. Please go to thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. That's Vinnie with a Y because it's the most important question. And Eastwood, like, go ahead. Make my news. And go ahead, start making regular donations today, either into the Kiwi Bank or the PayPal. And, you know, just make sure that all that money just keeps on flowing in so I can keep doing what I'm doing. We'll see you again sometime, folks.